The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello and welcome to the start of this year's Fiction Prize season. The Orange Prize got in early with its long list of 20 novels by women. And it just so happens that this very week we managed to lure one of the long-listed authors, Carol Birch, down to London to tell us about her really rather boyish novel of shipwrecks and dragons.
Something huge and dark came out of the scrub 20 yards or so ahead of us, running very fast on four bow legs. It plunged into the high savannah in the direction the deer had gone.
But we begin in Germany. You may have noticed there's been rather a lot of it in The Guardian this week, and that's because we've just embarked on a tour of our European neighbours, which will take us to four countries in as many weeks. We're aiming to look at every aspect of their cultures, from how they live, to what they eat, and, of course, the books that matter to them. Here in the studio with me is our very own Richard Lee of the book's website, and Simon Winder, whose latest book, Germania, is intended to do very much the same thing. Among the fascinating facts that he reveals is that the country got its very name from a book. The original Germania was written in 98 AD by the Roman historian Tacitus. But first, let's get a snapshot of what Germans are reading this week with our Berlin correspondent, Helen Pidd.
So in a bid to find out what modern Germans like to read, I've made a trip to Dussmann's, which is Berlin's, if not Germany's, biggest bookshop. It's right in the centre of the city on Friedrichstrasse, near an old border crossing, actually, where trains used to stop between east and west. I'm going to talk to a lady here called Bianca Krömer, who's going to talk me through the bestseller lists.
Number one spot is covered by Walter Kohl, and he's the son of former German Chancellor Helmut Kohl. He's one of the big outstanding German politicians, of course, known for tearing down the German wall. And it's the relationship to his father was. It's not that it wasn't such a harmonic relationship. Then, of course, very important still after so many months is Thilo Sarrazin, Deutschland schafft sich ab. It's a book that is discussed very controversially in Germany because he kind of speaks against ethnic intermingling, has very strong attitudes towards people not integrating into the German culture, and it has a big media coverage. So I think this is the reason why we sell it after, like, I think, like, so many months. He's on the top 10 list for, I think, almost a year now. So he must be a millionaire by now.
And Thilo Sarrazin, I mean, was he head of the finance on the Senate in Berlin?
Exactly. He was head of finance here in Berlin, and then he switched positions to the German central bank.
What I find quite interesting about this book, it's a bit of a doorstop. It's a big, thick book, and it's absolutely crammed full of statistics.
I'm so sure that not all the people who bought the book really read it. So, but it was like kind of like owning the book, showing the book around. Yeah, I kind of like know what Sarrazin said in his book.
So that's Thilo Sarrazin, Deutschland schafft sich ab, which means Germany's doing away with itself. So on the number two spot, I see what this is.
It's Amy Schur. Amy Schur is now known in Germany because also a lot of big, important newspapers write about her attitudes towards children's education.
So the book in German, it's called Die Mutter des Erfolgs, The Mother of Success. What else? So number eight, we've got a book by a guy called Richard David Precht, Wer bin ich? Und wenn ja, wie viele? Who am I? And if yes, how many?
And Richard David Precht is also for many, many, many months a best-selling author in our non-fiction department. He is a philosopher. But the way he writes about the self, about neurological issues, it's very nice to read. And he also is a guest in many talk shows. So he's a very handsome guy. He's very articulate and stuff. And so I think people really like him here.
Okay, he's also at the number 18 spot. I see something called Die Kunst, kein Egoist zu sein, The Art of Not Being an Egotist.
And he also released a book that was about love, like a philosophical travel to the subject of love.
And what's interesting, looking through the top 20 here, there aren't many authors that British people would recognise. You've got Keith Richards and his autobiography Life at number 19. There's a WikiLeaks book at number 13, not the Guardian one though. That's the one from Marcel Rosenbach and Helga Stark from The Spiegel. And the other theme that kind of jumps out at you here is all about eating and eating healthily?
That is at the moment a very big topic for the Germans. I think organic nutrition and what does it say about me as a person, the way I eat.
It's mostly pretty serious books we're looking at.
That's true. Like the only kind of like lighthearted is Joachim Fuchsberger, who used to be a very popular German TV host.
But he's a kind of grey-haired old man, and the book's called Altwerden ist nichts für Feiglinge. So getting old is not for cowards or not for sissies. What about the novels? So wandering through the ground floor of Dussmann's, there are a lot of books I recognise. There's Jonathan Franzen, Freiheit. There's Skippy Sterbt by Paul Murray. There's a few Philip Roth books here. Rose Tremaine seems to be doing quite well. Chris Cleave, John le Carré. I'm going to go talk to a lady now called Jacqueline, who leads up the fiction department of Dussmann. Actually, lots of German names here.
That's true. Like, it's Arno Geiger. It's a very important German author, very famous for his first novel, too, that won a very important prize. Then we have Horst Evers. That's a funny book. That's a book with a lot of humor and a very nice humor. Then we have Die Tribute von Panem by Susan Collins. This is actually like a book for youngsters, but it's a, what we call, as a bookseller, we call it like a all age. It's like Joan K. Rowling or Stephanie Meyer, and also Kerstin Gier, Rubinroth. That's like a typical all-age fiction. Then Jussi Adler Olsen, he is a Scandinavian author, a very, very, very best-selling for many, many months. And Martin Suter, he is also very popular. He is from Switzerland. He had a series from like crime, and now like, this is like a new series. Almen und die Libellen. I don't know what Libellen is. Like a little insect that is flying around.
Dragonfly, I think it's a dragonfly. Yeah. The book that's at the number one spot here, it looks very much like a Twilight kind of vampire book. It's called Gejagt, Hunted, by somebody called P.C. Kast and Kerstin Sest? Sast?
Kast. And they spell vampire not in a German manner, but in an English manner.
There seems to be a surprising popular interest in this kind of horror fiction stuff. When I went to the public library in the central Berlin district of Mitte to meet librarian Birgit Schurz, I found out it's not always the great giants of German literature that are in the most demand.
The main genre, over and over again, would be thrillers or crime stories. Next one would be, especially for younger women, vampire stories where a young woman falls in love with a vampire and tries to keep up with love.
And when we Brits, when we think about German literature, we think about the greats like Günter Grass, or I know he's Austrian, but Thomas Bernhard, authors like that. Are the books popular in this library?
Well, they do get borrowed, but I don't think people like to read it very much. It's mainly students who use it for school or for university. Well, Hertha Müller won the Nobel Prize last year, and well, we had to find out that there are only very few books in the libraries, and we bought up everything we could get her, and yeah, people liked to read it, but well, the demand isn't there anymore. It was there for a few weeks after the prize, but then it's off again.
Well, that's a bit sad, isn't it? That notoriously insular British bookworms might be more interested in the most literary German authors than the Germans themselves. Or is that just a Berlin thing, Simon?
Well, I think it's a fantastic interview. I mean, it's impossible not to laugh at the sheer earnestness of the non-fiction bestseller list. Yeah. And the idea of reading Helmut Kohl's son's memoir, I mean, however it's framed, just seems just an incredibly self-mutilating thing to do. But anyway,
yeah, lots
good
of
luck for them.
Lots of what we in this country would call stonkers there, Richard.
Yes, absolutely. There's that million-selling non-fiction bestseller, that Thilo Sarrazin book, Deutschland schafft sich ab, which I think is kind of Germany's going to the dogs, isn't it? Which is pretty strong stuff. There's the claim that, as he says, quotes, most of the cultural and economic problems are concentrated in a group of the 5 to 6 million immigrants from Muslim countries. It's kind of an extraordinary thing to say.
Is that, it's a bit worrying, isn't it, Simon?
Well, there is definitely something in the past year or so in Germany, which is, the studious politeness of Germans over some decades has been under huge pressure, I think, from the changes in the Eurozone and the degree to which they really feel like they've been taken for a ride by places like Ireland and Greece. And so you can see the civility cracking under the strain of this, I think justifiably in some ways, though this particular book does seem completely bonkers. But
Richard, there's quite a lot of worry about loss of German culture, isn't there?
And the slow dying out of the kind of German experience, the German language.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm in a position to say whether that's a new development or an old one. I mean, is that something that you think is very much of the time, or is that a long-standing concern?
I think it's always been an anxiety, and there's always been this incredible self-consciousness about high culture in Germany, which has always been gleefully undermined by most Germans who refuse to cooperate with having vast libraries of Goethe's plays and things like that. And so I think it's always been a tension, it's always been a rich vein in German literature, writing about how no one reads it.
But I mean, that's true over here. It's a kind of literary fiction in nobody reads it shock, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yes, I was puzzled by the librarian. I thought the idea that, you know, the more people buy something, the more valuable it has. I mean, all you need is one person to read Günter Grass once a week. You know, it's not, it doesn't matter.
One copy on their bookshelves that they read again and again and again over many years.
Or just a kind of, it seems to be the usual marketization of literary culture in a rather depressing way. So what if everyone wants to read vampire books? Doesn't mean they're good, which seems to be slightly the implication. It's very much a bookseller's view of the world.
Absolutely. Now let's go back to your book, Germania. Now, I said something a little bit controversial, which I must put out to you now about Tacitus, that Tacitus invented the word. He didn't actually invent it, did he? But he's taken to be the person who formulated the concept of Germanness.
Well, yes, it's a fascinating and complicated story because people, I think, always knew that Tacitus wrote a book called Germania, or Germania, or whatever. But it was discovered in the Renaissance in an abbey. I mean, so it was lost for 14 centuries. It was lost, and then one copy was found in this obscure library. And it did actually galvanise a whole generation of people. I think it was like 1450 or something like that. I can't remember now. But it was like a real shock to discover that there was this ancient document which described this place called Germania, which didn't exist then. I mean, it was a mass of different principalities. And so it really did make people think that Germany existed. And in fact, it was mainly Italian Renaissance scholars who studied the Tacitus and came up with this idea that it was, in fact, the truth about these ancient people. And therefore, in effect, the Germans ever since have been trying to conform in some more or less unsuccessful or disastrous way with this vision of Tacitus's, and we don't even know if he'd ever actually been there or whether most of it was secondhand.
Sort of fantasy. That's fascinating.
And a lot of it was very much based around, he used the idea of the Germans as being these pure, decent people, just as a means of satirizing Romans. And so we'll never know if it's true that they were honest in friendship and true to their wives, because he's just saying that in order to create a rather clunky metaphor for the realities of Roman life.
So. I'm just still reeling from the idea that those notions of racial purity could possibly have come about basically as a result of a satire, a kind of a Latin attempt to this kind of invention. It's kind of extraordinary notion.
Yes. Well, I think all countries have their founding myths, I suppose, don't they?
But the idea that the founding myth was a cheap crack at Roman society.
Well, I mean, I was exaggerating a little, but you can definitely read it as that. You know, that he doesn't care about the Germans at all. I mean, what he cares about is describing, it's amazing it exists, and there's a lot of accurate information in there, but we've got nothing to compare it with, because there's literally nothing else written about Germany for like 1,000 years after that. And so we just don't know, you know.
Now, Simon, let's just bring it back to your book, and you call it, you subtitle it A Personal History of Germany, Ancient and Modern. Why are you personally so fascinated with Germany?
Well, I thought it was important as a subtitle just to lower expectations a bit about the content, because it doesn't really set out to be a proper history of Germany in a textbooky way. It is just my things that interest me, and it's a kind of a happy coincidence if it actually interests other people as well. But it's a sort of, I suppose I can blame a particular book for it. It was this fantastic book by the historian Robert Bartlett, who wrote The Making of Europe in about, I think it was 1992, which is about like the settling of medieval Europe. And it made me zoom off to, I was living in America at the time, but I can't remember why now, I just jumped on a plane to zoom off to see Magdeburg and places like this. I came up with this idea that Magdeburg was somehow like the Pentagon for the early Middle Ages, that it was this kind of centre for enforced sort of Christianization and invasion of Central Europe by German speakers. And that kind of, the book's been sort of bubbling away ever since.
There's a very particular history, isn't there, which comes from the fact that it was so many little, very competitive principalities. Tell us about some of these.
Well, I mean, until relatively recently, the map of Germany looked like someone had thrown up a jigsaw. I mean, it was the most appalling mess of tiny little places. You had states like Prüm, the only asset of which was one of the shoes that Jesus wore, which was just a small group of monks who looked after this shoe, which in defensive terms wasn't brilliant, and they were always rather vulnerable to their neighbours.
Just wave it in the air.
Absolutely. Well, there's a great little place called Quedlingburg, which was a tiny republic run by aristocratic women whose only job was to pray for the soul of the Emperor Henry the Fowler. And this place is so fascinating because it existed from, there's an area called the New Town, which sounds sort of funky, except that it was built in like 1100, and that was the last thing that happened there. But I think what's interesting about places like Quedlingburg is that so their only point was to look after the body of Henry the Fowler. But in the end, this blamelessly daft history bit them because from the Nazi point of view, Henry the Fowler was one of their great founding figures. You know, he was one of the great, he was the hammer of the Slavs. And so they turned the very beautiful little abbey church in Quedlingburg into a kind of SS shrine and they reinterred Henry the Fowler. And these appalling photos of Himmler and everyone arriving for this ludicrous fake pagan ceremony. And then for the rest of the Nazi regime, the whole town was like a temple. And then, of course, the whole thing was denazified at the end of the war. And you can still see the smashed remains of the giant eagle with a swastika in its claws, which filled the end of the nave in this church. And so the role of history and all that becomes obviously incredibly abusive and distressing.
Now, you end your book in 1933.
Yes.
And this is presumably because you don't want to deal with all that stuff.
Yes. I mean, it's just a lowering feeling when you get to 1933 that if I'm going to write a book about why Germany's such an enjoyable and interesting place, obviously it stops being an enjoyable and interesting place in 1933. And so it seemed like pointless to go on with the rehearsal of well-known facts, and that by stopping there both elides a particular problem I had, that the kind of facetious tone I'd adopted throughout the book, which many people find so grating, just wouldn't work when Hitler comes to power. But equally it allowed people to think of German history as not being in any way a run-up to 1933. 1933 is a particular disaster and a very particular series of cowardices and terrible bits of bad luck and an insane ideology which is you really can't track back even to during the First World War, let alone earlier.
Let's just go back a little bit earlier and talk about how Germany has been regarded from our perspective. I mean, the Victorians were very taken with it, weren't they? I mean, people like Carlyle, Thackeray, Meredith.
Yes, Gladstone would engage in no doubt unbelievably uninteresting theological discussions with various Bavarian academics and theologians for his holiday each year. I think what's interesting is the way Britain and Germany become, in effect, twins. I mean, they are the two big Protestant states in Europe. They both share the same kind of superiority complex over their neighbours, which is a very peculiar thing in its own right. And it's there divorce in 1914, which is so peculiar because, you know, as you say, the Victorians loved it. Everyone was going on these, no doubt, interesting trips up and down the Rhine. You know, everyone drank hock until the 1914 when they switched to French sauces and German wines never recovered since. But, you know, effectively, those kinds of links. The other day I was looking at these photos of George V visiting the Kaiser before the war in this photo library. And, of course, he's wearing a spiked helmet, like, because he was is in one of these Prussian Guard regiments or whatever, as an honorary colonel. And still there's a little thing under in the library saying, not for reproduction, you cannot use this picture. And clearly there's a whole range of pictures of the royal family, because they all loved the Germans, you know. Mm. I was reading about Wilhelm coming to Dorset for a few weeks and staying with his family and running and having this hilariously stiff, I'm sure, children's party for all the local children of Christchurch in Dorset, where his patisserie made a giant model of the abbey in Christchurch out of cake and all these, I'm sure, terrified children.
So Richard, by the time Forster came to write Howard's End, things were changing, if one indeed believes a novelist.
Well, in Howard's End, Forster wrote that the father of the Schlegels mourned, "Your poets are dying, your musicians to whom Europe has listened for 200 years, gone. Gone with the little courts that nurtured them, gone with Esterhaz and Weimar."
So maybe that's our answer, Simon. Everyone was already regretting the loss of German culture.
Yes, no, I think that's right, because it's true that these little places, like if you were to spend 4 or 5 days in, I don't know, not to be unfair, but say Tring, you'd be considered insane. And yet the German equivalent would be somewhere like Weimar or Goethe or Altenburg, which are in fact are genuinely culturally really important. And it was the willingness of local rulers to nurture really major talent which is an astonishing difference with Britain. You know, effectively, people move to London on the whole in order to be famous, whereas in Germany for a long time there was this incredible patchwork of culture.
And they were competitive with each other, weren't they? I mean, don't you posit that actually the reason that Bach ended up being Bach was because of competitiveness between his benefactors?
Yes, that's right. Yes, he was having a bad time in Weimar, and so the guy who ran this microstate called Curtin, he happened to be a talented clarinetist, and so he said to Bach, why don't you come and work for me for a bit? And because he happened to be a Calvinist, because again it was a patchwork of religion, he didn't want any religious music. And so Bach had time on his hands, so he invented secular classical music basically in the space of a couple of years, thanks to this invitation from this one rather nice guy.
I particularly like the story of the late 18th century Duke Karl August, who had 38 cavalrymen and 36 infantry in his army, but nevertheless had Goethe as his chief advisor.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of hilarious stories about him.
Schiller and Hegel at the university. Yeah,
he was an extraordinary bloke, because though he had the best of intentions, in the end he loved going hunting. He invented the Weimaraner dog, for example, as his hunting dog. And Goethe was always trying to make everything much more sensible and serious, and he really couldn't bear it, because halfway through a concert there'd be more or less equivalent of a burping competition, or the dogs would jump up and grab some food or whatever, and the Duke would laugh. And so Goethe used to go down to this wonderful place called Ilmenau, where there was, as it turned out, a broken silver mine, and it was the only source of revenue in the whole place. So Goethe would go down there to try and persuade the locals to get the silver mine working, but the whole place was flooded, and he'd give up, and he'd go on these enormous walks where he wrote poetry, where he more or less invented German geology. And you can still follow his walk to see the rocks he used to, I'm sure, rather despairingly stare at, wondering what the hell he was doing with his life.
OK, now we're going to bring you forward into the present. And we've heard a little bit about Germans' obsession with health food, but this wasn't your experience in Frankfurt, was it?
No, I'm quite scarred by German food, actually. A lot of it's absolutely delicious, without being too stereotypical. I mean, they do great things with things like asparagus and geese. But there was one meal I get there for the Frankfurt Book Fair, and I thought it'd be fun to go to a really echt German restaurant of a very local kind. And there were people next to us having a block of lard, which they cut up with a wire and put on blocks of pumpernickel. And then I had something, admittedly, was a courting disaster, called a slaughterhouse plate, which was a pile of sauerkraut, which was fine. But then there was a series of, in effect, liquefied forms of meat and blood put together inside bits of skin, which are literally with surgical clips at the end of them. If you touch them with your fork, they sort of detumesce over the sauerkraut. Anyway, luckily, there was an Italian restaurant opposite where we moved on to.
Well, you'll have to read Germania for yourself to hear more of these glorious anecdotes, and you can get it from Picador. Now, Simon, we have also brought you here to join our World Book Tour. We've been collecting thoughts from our readers on what they think are the best books coming out of Germany. And we've so far, and we've only had it up for a week, received nearly 200 nominations. Richard, it's your brainchild, this. Can you talk us through it?
No, I don't know if it's really mine. It's an old idea that we've reskinned with some new technology. So we're gradually creating a database of the best in German fiction. But the original idea comes back to a reader, one of our users, years ago, called Diego, who thought, what a great idea to ask people who know out there in the world and the internet about the best books. So here we are with a new way of doing it, back in Germany. And we've had lots of nominations for the usual suspects, the greats of German literature. We've got Goethe, we've got Heinrich Böll, we've got Thomas Mann, W.G. Sebald. But there's also an interesting kind of shading into German language literature. We've got Joseph Roth or Ingeborg Bachmann. We've even got Kafka, who's born in Prague.
Would you consider them to be German, Simon?
Well, I think they're the centre of the storm about, you know, in effect, you know, Kafka is Jewish and he's German and he's Czech and he's an Austro-Hungarian Habsburg subject. He's one of these figures like Mahler, who basically wouldn't be allowed to exist anymore in one way or another. So yes, he is German, but in effect he's doomed by the 20th century to be a refugee from all kinds of... The Czechs claim him now as a Czech writer, but I don't think he would view himself as a Czech writer.
Mm. We've also got some less well-known writers. For example, the unfortunately only too resonant Accident. That's Christa Wolfe, about a nuclear power catastrophe. That's recommended by Stan Persky. And I was delighted to see three nominations for Jenny Erpenbeck, who's a recent discovery from me, including two for her most recent novel, Visitation.
Yes, we've got Aggie H, who says she's got exquisite writing and remarkable that any author that can find a new and relevant way to tell stories based on relatively recent German history.
I know Michel Faber would second you on that, Aggie H. He was the reviewer who brought it to our attention at The Guardian. There are several poetry nominations as well. A.S., or someone who goes by those initials, recommends Christian Morgenstern, who I haven't actually heard of before, Richard.
Yeah, no, to be honest, neither have I, but A.S. asks, can we translate poetry? Obviously, Morgenstern is extremely funny and includes some of the most original and hilarious wordplay in German literature, but this translation is really a work of art in itself. That's in the 1960s translation by Max Knight. Though I believe Anthea Bell has done one more recently, he says. But again, this is one of the glories of the World Literature Tour, in that here we are recommending books that you and I have never seen before. It's our users coming to the fore once again.
Yeah, and there's another one, which is for The Ship by Hans Henny Jahn, and I'm probably terribly mispronouncing it, I do apologise. And it's part of a trilogy by somebody who I presume would belong among Simon's great German eccentrics. He was a writer, playwright, he was renowned for his discovery and publishing of Baroque music. He was an organ builder and restorer and a hormone researcher. He died in 1959. According to one fan who goes under the name JLR, it made him feel seasick the whole way through. And that brings us neatly round to another writer who set her most recent novel on the high seas. It's Carol Birch, whose Jamrach's Menagerie has just been selected for the Orange Longlist. We're especially pleased because it's forced her to come down to visit us from her home in Lancaster. We've been pestering her to do so ever since our fiction editor discovered Jamrach back in the winter blizzards. Welcome, Carol.
Thank you.
So tell us, who was Jamrach and why does he feature in your book?
He was a man who kept a menagerie in the East End of London, right by the docks where all the, near the tobacco dock where all the sort of brandy and tobacco and exotic spices and so on used to come in.
Which is now Wapping, isn't it?
It's Wapping, mm-hmm. Yes. And because, you know, his father had been there for years. His father had a business before he did and then he took it over. And he was ideally situated so that the sailors coming in off the boats could bring in curios from all over the world. And his father had been a major supplier of wild animals, and he took that over, and I think his son then took over after him. It was in the family.
But in a way, he's quite a marginal figure, isn't he?
In the book, yes.
In the book, he is.
Yes.
The main character is Jaffy.
Is Jaffy.
Yes, tell us about Jaffy.
Jaffy, I came across the story of Jamrach and the tiger and the little boy, which is a true story. That there was an escaped tiger that got out of its cage as it came off the docks and escaped and was walking down Ratcliffe Highway. And everybody, of course, ran away. And the story goes that this 8-year-old boy just walked up to it and stroked it on the nose. And I was taken by this somehow. I don't quite know why this lodged in my mind. And I started making up this fictional little boy and what it would be like for this little boy who's never come across anything like this. I think it must change you to be walking down the street in an ordinary place and suddenly meet a wild animal and be carried away with it. And I started making this story about Jaffy, and he just grew and grew and grew.
And there is, of course, a statue in the tobacco dock.
Yes, I didn't know about this when I started.
The little boy and the tiger, Jaffy and the tiger, is not the only real event in the book. There's also, of course, the shipwreck.
There's the shipwreck, yes. And that just came together quite fortuitously because I was writing the story about Jaffy anyway, this little boy, and I wasn't quite sure where I was going with it. And sometime around the same time, I read quite widely, and I just was reading about the whale ship Essex and the survivors' accounts, because fortunately, that's very, very well documented. The survivors left 3 or 4 accounts, and they were fascinating. They were absolutely fascinating, and it was such a very harrowing story, but at the same time, to me, I felt that there was this beautiful dimension in it somehow. I know it sounds weird to people, but the accounts that are left are very stark in a way. They're very impersonal. And I kept thinking, what was that like for those boys? You know, they were very young. They were very, very young boys. That was another thing that struck me. And the whole thing kind of came together with Jaffy.
And this was the a boat that inspired Herman Melville to write Moby Dick, wasn't it?
It's a very famous case. It was a really famous wreck, and the Essex was sunk by a whale.
But here again, it's only actually glancingly referred to, because the boat that Jaffe is on, he's sent off to pursue a wild animal, which we'll hear more about later.
Yes, that's completely fictional.
They just refer to it, and yet I'm very interested in the way that you use history.
I wanted them to refer to it because I didn't want people thinking that I was actually trying to write the Essex itself, but it was very much inspired by the Essex, which is also, the Essex has inspired other things as well, not just Melville, but there's a story by Edgar Allan Poe, and I think Jack London also did something.
Now, you've written novels about real people before, particularly Skate Gallows, wasn't it? Which was about the horse thief, wasn't
Margaret
it?
Margaret Catchpole.
That's a rather reductive way to refer to the wonderful Margaret
Catchpole, isn't it? Yes.
So what is it with real people?
Well, I've only done it with those two books, actually, so it's just fairly recent, this, and historically as well. I mean, my historical books, it's only been the last three, really. Mm. Before that, I don't think I was confident enough to tackle history, but I realised at some stage that I could. You know, it was when I was doing Turn Again Home and I had to do the research of people fighting in the jungles of Malaya. I realised then that I could write about things that I hadn't actually experienced myself. And it was fascinating. So I then had the confidence to go on and write about history. Margaret just came along because I was on holiday in East Anglia, where she lived, and you know, she's very well known down there, and came across her there and found her quite fascinating. And then I got hold of her letters home from Australia, which were in her own words and her own handwriting, and I sort of got her voice from that and just wanted to tell her story.
Mm-hmm. Now let's go back to Jamrach. I'd like you to read a little bit, and the bit that I've asked you to read is about the discovery of what Jaffe and the shipmates think is a real live dragon. And the reason I wanted you to read this is because it struck me that what you do here is you're writing history from the inside out, as opposed to what I would call costume drama, writing history from the outside in. It's so evocative of what it must feel like to find something that's completely outside your experience.
The Malay with the tattoo held up his hand and everyone froze. How long we did not move, I don't know. Everything became very clear, every blade of grass. When I swallowed, my throat creaked. Dan motioned us cautiously forward with his hand without even looking back. We crept. And when we were gathered, sudden, so my heart jumped up like a man started from sleep by a bell. Bolt upright, stab. Then the hammering, as of a demented woodpecker, a deer, leaping across the path ahead of us. One instant, a graceful prancing arc, and it was gone into the long grass. We stood staring and waiting. The silence roared. Then we followed the Malay's stalking feet, step by wary step, a distance of no more than a few yards before we stopped again, brought up short by a stink like a blocked privy. The grass sang. Something huge and dark came out of the scrub, 20 yards or so ahead of us, running very fast on four bow legs. It plunged into the high savannah in the direction the deer had gone. Time speeded up. We moved forward at a good pace, and all I knew was the high grasses on either side of me whispering at our passage, and the back of Dan's head, and my shoulders hurting, and my breath beginning to scrape a little. A good hour of it, till we slowed down and closed ranks again, close by the edge of some kind of rocky escarpment. There could be no more talking. We'd come so far now into the island that I'd lost all sense of scale and direction, and had no idea which way the ship was, or how far away. No idea whether the rock face to our right was the height of two tall men or as high as a mountain. The quick black shadow had scuttled before my eyes a million times as we walked. How many more of those things were out there, hiding in the heavy brush, watching with hard reptilian eyes? I was never more afraid, but never so brightly aware. I felt as if my eyes were wide and overbright, and the others looked the same. Even the Malays, whom I'd considered knowing and unshakable and well-nigh invulnerable, all but shimmered with an unhinged energy. I'd faced the great whales, but they were known. And now a dumb show began. Our blood was up. We were in the wild, and the wild has teeth and claws and eyes and a stink like the rotting of a day-old carcass. I saw only a dark living bulk of great size, four bandy legs running,
so fast. Dan and the Malays talked with their hands and shoulders and eyes. I wanted to be Dan. I wanted his gift for roaming the world, talking to everyone he met. I wanted his ease in outlandish places, and the way he never seemed afraid. I wanted the fear that moved in my belly to transmute into serenity. The smaller of the two Malays spotted blood. Something is leaving a trail. He moved his forearm in such a way, how he did it, I don't know. He made it look like a deer. Palm towards us, keeping us back, he went forward. For a while, he stood absolutely motionless, looking through the thinning bush, then beckoned us cautiously on. We came like ghosts. I saw the deer first through the high grass. She was far away on the side of a long, balding slope, near dead, her blood trail following her faithfully, not quite to the shadow of the rock to which she'd dragged herself. She'd collapsed in the dust. A stain of blood widened about her, and she was trying, hopelessly but doggedly, to raise her head up sideways. Then I saw the dragon, just above and beyond us, completely still on a low wrinkle of land overlooking the plain, no more than a deck's length from me. A huge brownish-grey thing with black head and legs, bigger than a tiger, longer and lower, but raising its powerful chest and head as high at the front and trailing behind it a mighty weapon of a tail.
Oh, I love the way that Jaffe can only describe the monstrousness of it in terms of whales and tigers, things he's already seen.
Yes.
Was that a conscious decision on your part?
No. Well, when I write something like that, I try and imagine that I am, you know, in the little boy, really. And I don't consciously think, oh, you know, he'd see it like this or he'd see it like that. I just try and do it somehow. I write in quite a haphazard way, really. And when sometimes people say, oh, you did this and you did that. And I think, yes, I did, but I didn't necessarily do it consciously.
This presumably is a Komodo dragon, is it? What we
it
would
is.
Know as a Komodo dragon.
It is, the Komodo dragon. Well, they didn't know it in those days. I was surprised, actually, to find out myself that they... Komodo dragon was only actually officially known about in the West in 1912, which is quite late.
And
before that, apparently, there were simply travellers' tales of this big dragon-like beast.
So Jamrach never did bring a Komodo dragon back to London?
Oh, no, not at all. This was completely fictional, you know, that's totally not true.
So, of course, they get onto the boat with the Komodo dragon, and... This is when things begin to go terribly spooky, and because their superstition collides with this fear of the creature, doesn't it?
And also we have a boy on board who is a little bit unstable and slightly mystical in his way of thinking, who, you know, the boy Skip, who kind of whips things up a little bit, you know, with this sort of his strange fascination himself with the dragon, and sits and stares at it for hours on end and so on, talks to it. And he kind of, I think he's part of the whole problem, really, of why people start to kind of feel this superstition about the dragon, this kind of, because as soon as the dragon comes on board, bad luck starts. Mm.
Well, it's a bit like the Ancient Mariner, isn't it?
It is a little bit, yes.
And we know of how superstition can turn people's minds in those
situations. And on ships,
situations.
Particularly sailors were very prone to all kinds of sort of strange beliefs and... Mm.
Now, a shipwreck story, which this is at its heart...
At its heart, yes.
...is a very populist form, isn't it? It's a very old and venerable populist
Absolutely.
Form. Absolutely. Why did you choose this form?
I didn't really choose it. It chose me, I think. That's the answer to that one. I mean, I just became fascinated by those stories, and they came together, and I thought, I could really write this, rather than choosing it. In fact, it probably wasn't the greatest choice. I mean, when I mentioned it to a couple of people, they said, oh, no, you know, what a horrible story.
Because it's bad news, because it's...
Well, you know, because it does get... I mean, I don't know if I can mention what happens in case people don't know what happens.
Yeah.
But, you know, it does get quite disturbing. And so some people just sort of saw it like that. And I always felt that I wanted to go beyond that. I didn't want it to be just a story about something grim. I wanted to point out that there was actually something quite beautiful about this story to me, which I hope is what came across in the book in the end. You know, I didn't want it to be just a gruesome story. About what happened at sea. It was also quite transcendent to me in a way, and I thought about that when I thought of the people who'd survived these things. And I'm always fascinated when I do read about the things that people can survive and do survive and how they come through it and stay sane and live lives.
I'm reviewing The Return of Eliza Quinn in 2005 for us, that's The Guardian. Okay. DJ Taylor said, nothing could be more literary than the fugitive lyricism of the prose, the delicate hint-strewing of the plot lines or the devious economy of the dialogue. Their subject matter, talking of your novels in the plural, on the other hand, comes straight out of the rows of buxom mass-market sagas that stack up on the supermarket shelf, all clogs, shawls, dense Mancunian fogs and the turbulent march of history.
It always makes me laugh because I suppose some of the forms I choose are ones which are very easily pigeonholed. And when I did, for example, Turn Again Home before that, I don't know how many times I read the phrase clogs and shawl. And I don't think there was a clog and shawl in that book at all. But because it was a family saga, it was about a family over 100 years in Manchester, everybody thought family saga, clogs, shawls, north. I'd like to take something that has that kind of, I suppose, hackneyed image, like a family saga or a shipwreck novel or whatever, and push it further than that and say, you know, this is actually a valid form.
It does give you a space. I mean, this seems to me this is the space you've claimed, you've reclaimed some sort of populist tropes.
Again, I don't do it consciously. I just, something gets hold of me and I decide I'm going to do that because it wants to be written by me. That's the, sounds a bit silly, but that's the way it feels.
Carol Birch there. She's got as far as the Booker long list before, and I just wonder if this might be her year. Jamrak's Menagerie is published by Canongate. And that's all for this week's podcast. But before we go, Richard is going to run us through some of the treats to look forward to in the coming week.
In tomorrow's Guardian Review, we will be asking literary editors of the major newspapers in Germany, France, Spain and Poland what they think are the most important books from their respective countries. And also in the Observer's new review this Sunday, where there's an interview with the poet Michael Longley. And also don't forget, if you'd like to contribute your suggestions to our World Literature Tour, you can find that on guardian.co.uk/books.
And also do become a regular subscriber through iTunes. We'll shortly be putting up this week's rather wonderful book club session with Margaret Drabble. And don't forget our new children's website. We're still waiting for someone under 17 to write in asking for an interview with the best-selling German novelist Cornelia Funke, who has received several recommendations from our adult literature tourists. We'll be in France next week for the second stage of our European tour. In the meantime, from me, Claire Armistead, Richard Lee, Simon Winder, and our producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.